Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. It is Wednesday, August 26th, and it is 10:49 and 50 seconds, so we're going to get started. Okay? Usually I don't start early. Usually I don't end late, but today we'll just get started a little bit early. This is your class, right? Here's the syllabus for Bio 231. So if you're in this room for a different class, then you're in the wrong room. But I think probably most everybody is in here for human anatomy because I recognize some faces. All right, I'm going to turn some of these lights down so you can see the screen and look at that nice improvement. I can show two different screens. That's going to be really helpful for me and for you. Any question on the syllabus? I reviewed some things about the syllabus. Here's that schedule. Make sure you pay attention to the schedule. But notice the schedule says tentative, and it might change during the semester if something happens. But I suspect that it's going to go pretty smooth, just like this. What other things that are on the syllabus? What's one more thing on the syllabus that is mission critical that you should know? It's not on the schedule. I should probably put it on the schedule, but I don't have a day of the week on the schedule to put it. That's a hint. Thursday. I don't have Thursdays on the schedule. Is Thursdays, that ringing a bell? Online assignments. That's the deadline for online assignments. Remember, you can take these quizzes an unlimited number of times before the deadline. How many times after the deadline?
Zero.
Even if your computer breaks. How many times after the deadline? Even if there's a terrible accident. How many times after the deadline? Zero times, right? So prepare ahead of time. And if you stay at least 1 week ahead, you'll never miss a deadline, right? So stay abreast of the class and even 1 week ahead online. That's important. All right, so that's it for syllabus, unless somebody has a question about grading and that kind of stuff. Yeah?
It says one of the requirements we need is a Cypress or Polish ID.
Yeah.
Verified.
Yeah.
That's barely not
worth it. Get a student ID, because I know for sure you're a student here. Okay, administration and records can get one to you in, I don't know, a minute or so, something like that. Yeah, Fullerton College works, and you'll need an ID if you ever want to use the Learning Resource Center, and sometimes you might want to do that. Okay, that's a pretty good question. So that ID for the test when you turn it in. Okay, I don't check for practicums, but for lecture exams I do, and here is the whole reason why I do. Is because I teach online classes, and online classes I have no idea who the students are, and so I do ask for ID for my online classes, and I can't treat them any different than I treat you. So then you're kind of forced to bring IDs too, right? Even though I will get to know everybody pretty well. Okay, so that's it for the schedule. I'll put it away. There's one figure that I couldn't talk about last time, and I want to show you this time. Okay, and it is this figure right here. There's an A and B part to it. And it is an exam figure, and I'm sure everybody would have persevered and looked through this illustration, but it seems a little bit complicated, and I just want to reinforce how important this figure is to you, and also the next one as well. All right, here's that posterior view. Here are a bunch of anatomic terms, and for different areas in the body. So for instance, this region, anterior, in the thorax, right smack in the middle, you do have a bone right there called the sternum, and notice what this area is called. It's called the sternal area. So when you learn these terms right here, that will help you name hundreds of other kinds of things throughout the anatomy class. So this is going to be really helpful for nomenclature. Orbital refers to the eye. That's going to be important. And acromial, the tip of your shoulder over here, that's going to be a very important landmark on a bone, namely the scapula, for instance. Carpal region, your wrist, there are bones in there that we call carpals, a whole group of them. All of those will be called carpals. They do have individual names. Here is the mental region, the tip of somebody's chin right here. I don't know the origin of that word mental, but maybe somebody was thinking really hard, what are we going to call the name of that part of the body, right? And so they called it, I'm thinking hard while I'm pointing my finger to my chin. That's the mental region. But if you know that is the mental region, you also know the name of a muscle that is there automatically without studying anything, and it's called the mentalis. So we'll use that all the time. Your armpit is your axillary region. And in that axillary region, you have an axillary artery, you have an axillary vein, you have an axillary nerve. So you learn just a whole bunch of anatomy that you're going to use throughout this semester if you're familiar with these two diagrams. And you have drag and drop, and that will help you. You can practice that over and over and over again. And another technique you can use that will help you memorize this particular figure and pretty much any of the figures is a good example of that would be the extra credit assignment in lab this week. What was the extra credit assignment in lab? Drawing on a blank piece of paper. That's right. If there's no way that this is going to sink into your memory, doing drag and drop and looking at this picture, one thing that you can do is draw it out on a blank piece of paper a couple times and then draw it out on a blank piece of paper without using a book. And that's just going to help make connections in your brain. Hopefully you can remember. And then another really good technique is when you read something, you use one part of your brain. When you speak those words, you use different parts of your brain and actually a whole lot of different parts of your brain that are interconnected to each other. And that will help you remember things. So when you are learning anatomy, it is really handy to talk to somebody about anatomy. Use those terms, and even if it's your grandmother, all right, you can talk about the structure of a knee or a back or a nerve or something, and maybe they won't really appreciate what you're saying, but they'll kind of be interested, and you get to practice using that language. So it's important to practice that language, right? You could talk to your kids, and you know what? Your kids might actually know more than me about it, or you. So don't be afraid to talk to people about anatomy. That will help you learn the material. All right, so that's the last thing from chapter one that I wanted to talk about. Oh, but first, I forgot. I was going to give you a quiz, right, just as a review. What did we do? Body cavities, we're going to review that in lab. What else did we talk about? Oh, directional terms, we're going to do that in lab. Body planes, we'll do in lab. We talked about that last time, but let's just do that really quick, right? And this will just show you that repetition is a good study technique as well. All right, so how many body planes are there? They're perpendicular to each other. Yeah, there are three, right? And so when I hold my hand, you just tell me which body plane it is. So, for instance, this body plane, separating superior from inferior, transverse, right. What about this one up here? Okay, what about this one up here? That's transverse, all right, we started here. What about this one here? Transverse. All of these are transverse. There's nothing special about them. Of course, the body area changes, all right. What about this one? Sagittal, separates right from left. What about over here? Still sagittal. What about right here? That is a sagittal, but you're right, special case, it is mid-sagittal. You could even call it median if you want to, because I read the textbook, but hardly anybody else calls it median, okay? Okay, so we got transverse. Thank you. Okay, it goes like that. And then the last one, frontal, and that can slide back and forth too, just like transverse. Right. Sometimes there are organs in your body that aren't arranged precisely on a grid. Your heart is one of those organs. And is your heart an important organ in your body? Indeed. We image it a lot. Your heart is not straight, superior, inferior. It is angulated a little bit. Okay, as you go from the bottom to the top, it's angulated over to the left, and that's why everybody kind of knows more of your heart is on the left side of your body compared to the right. When you take one of those standard imaging planes and angulate it, it's got a special name that's called oblique. Yeah, so oblique is angulated. All right, but the other three are nice and perpendicular to each other. I forgot to mention that oblique. As a matter of fact, I just remembered that right now. Okay, any questions for chapter one? Pretty good. How's it going in Blackboard? Are you mousing around in Blackboard, finding the syllabus, the lecture slides? That kind of material. All right, so this week, absolutely positively, and as a matter of fact, by the end of today, everybody that's registered for the class should be able to get into Blackboard. And if you are not successful, then you have to contact me. And we got to make sure that you can get in there. That is really critical that you're able to do that. I know I had to work with some people remotely, And I think I answered everybody's question, but did somebody send me an email saying I can't get into Blackboard and I haven't responded yet? I think I responded to all the emails. Great. Okay. So that's good. I'm not delinquent with that. So let's move on to chapter number 2. So again, don't be shy to ask me for help, how to get into Blackboard. And as a matter of fact, ask me before you ask anybody else on campus. That's probably good. Because sometimes if you ask somebody else on campus and they'll say, well, did you ask your instructor? They'll get mad at me. Okay? So ask me first, and then you don't have to go to anybody else, and that might wreck their day. I'm not sure. Okay. All right, so we're going to move from introductory material, chapter 1, to chapter 2, which we have right here, which I have showing on the left. And let's pull up a slide on the right. All right, and here it is right here. So that's pretty cool. This is usually how I lecture in class. Pictures on the right, text slides on the left, and I can go back and forth pretty easily. All right, so last time we talked about a bunch of building blocks. And there's a hierarchical level of organization that you should be aware of. And that is, if we put a bunch of molecules together, molecules are a building block for what kind of structure, right? Because this is anatomy. What kind of structure? If we put a whole bunch of these microscopic, not even microscopic, submicroscopic particles together that have a particular shape, what can they build? An organelle. I like that a lot, an organelle. Some books have it a little bit different. Sometimes they have like molecule. They might have chemical and molecule. Molecule is just a little bit bigger kind of chemical. But put chemicals or molecules together, we get an organelle. And the organelle is a building block for something as well. Does anybody remember what organelles are a building block for? Cells. Yeah. All right. And so also cells are a building block for something. What are they a building block of? Okay, they're a building block of tissues. And I want to change your thinking a little bit. Instead of just thinking of building block, I want you to understand something that I call a structural and functional unit. Right? And so if something has a certain structure, it has a certain function. So I want you to think about function a little bit too in this class. And so what is the structural and functional unit of life? It's a cell, right? So a cell is a building block of a tissue, but it is also the essential item that makes life up, right? If something is alive, it has to be made out of a cell. And maybe I didn't mention it last time, right? So the structural and functional unit of life is a cell. So we want to know something about the structure of cells. And if we do, then we know a little bit about the function of cells. And if you understand how one cell stays alive, you know pretty much how all cells stay alive, because it is that structural and functional unit of life. So cells are really interesting for that standpoint. Well, what do you need to be a cell? You need three things, and I see it on this illustration right here. First, you need something that separates the living world from the non-living world, and that is what we call the cell membrane. I'm outlining it right now with my cursor. This is the cell membrane. Everything outside is basically the non-living world. Everything inside is just a soup of molecules that produces life inside of the cell. Inside the cell, there are two compartments. There's a compartment that contains genetic material. And genetic material is important for life because this is the material that can get passed on, can pass information from one generation to the next, to the next, to the next. And that's why sometimes you kind of look like your grandma or your grandpa. Sometimes you kind of look like your parents. And sometimes you're a combination of the two. And we call that genetics. It gets complicated, but it's all of this stuff inside the nucleus that will determine what the possibilities are. Right? So for life, number one, cell membrane. Number two, genetic material. And then number three, cytoplasm. All of this stuff between the cell membrane and the nucleus is cytoplasm. That includes organelles like mitochondria, rough endoplasmic reticulum, and then the fluid that all of these things are suspended in. The fluid that suspends everything inside the cell is what we call cytosol. Cytosol. All right, so cytoplasm can be broken down into two things, organelles and cytosol. But I'm just going to refer to this stuff as cytoplasm for right now. All right, so is this thing a cell? I see a cell membrane. I see cytoplasm, and I see genetic material. Is this a cell by definition? Yeah, it qualifies. It has all those three components to it. Let's think of something else. A bacteria has genetic material. It's not inside of a nucleus, but it is inside a cell membrane. It has genetic material, so it can pass information from generation to generation. It has living fluids inside of it. It has cytoplasm. Right? So bacteria has genetic material, cytoplasm, and a cell wall. So is a bacterium alive? Is it a living thing? Yeah, it's a living thing. Right? And if you get a bacterial infection, one way to treat that bacterial infection is to kill it. Right? If it's alive, you can kill it. Now let's consider something a little bit smaller, actually a lot smaller, that's a virus. Let me tell you what a virus is made up of. It has genetic material. It has no cytoplasm. And it has something that looks more like a cell wall, and it is not a cell membrane. Right? A virus can cause an infection. Right? But is a virus alive? Is it a living thing? It is not, because it's missing cytoplasm. Right, and it's missing a cell membrane, so it is not alive. So when you treat a viral infection, can you give your body something that will kill a virus so that you get over that infection? And the answer is no, because you can't kill something that's not alive. That's really strange, right? So viral infections typically are a lot more troublesome to treat, and we have to think of other mechanisms, right, to control that infection. All right, that's all I can say about viruses in this class. All right, so here is the basic unit of life. It's also a building block of tissue, like we said, but in order to understand life, we need to know a little bit more of what's happening inside the cell. And since this is an anatomy class, we want to look at structures first. That's the most important thing. And when you're able to identify these organelles by their structure, you'll know something about their function. And on the test coming up, I might show you this illustration right here. Right, so I'll have a lead line pointing to this thing that kind of looks like a tiny little kidney bean. And I could ask you, what's the function of this thing? So you'll be able to recognize it by its shape. And then because you're studying, you can tell me what the function is. And that's the purpose of today's lecture, to go over the function of some of these things. Right, and I'll give you maybe one or two items per organelle, and your book might give you 10 or 20 different kinds of functions for an organelle, but chances are I would test you on something that I say in lecture, right? So I'll narrow it down for you. All right, what was the first organelle that I talked about? Okay, that cell membrane, right? So a lot of people wouldn't recognize the cell membrane as an organelle, but it is. It's really special. So let's talk about a cell membrane, or plasma membrane is the same thing, right? So that separates the outside dead world with the inside living world. And if we zoom in, let's zoom into just this little part of the cell. It's a teeny, teeny, tiny part. And zoom even further, we'll magnify this. This is a typical cell membrane. There is a repeating pattern that should stand out. Okay, it's complicated by some things, but there's a repeating pattern that maybe sticks out that we should characterize this membrane by. Ooh, I didn't mean that. That's sort of a pun. By. By means two. I see two layers when I look at a cell membrane, right? I see this thing that looks like a head and some tails over here, and then flipped upside down, I see some tails and a head over here. They oppose each other. I see two layers. And here's that line that separates the two layers through there. Can everybody see, right? You have to look through a bunch of other things, but you see two layers of something right here and right here, and I see two layers over here, right? That is a very nice, simple way to understand a cell membrane. This molecule is special. It's called a phospholipid. It's part lipid, part phosphate. You'll study this a lot when you get to a physiology class, but right now, if you just know that's a phospholipid, that's cool. How many layers of phospholipids make up a cell membrane? Two. So one way to talk about the cell membrane is phospholipid bilayer. That's a really nice understanding of it. The really cool thing about cell membranes is if you get a bunch of these phospholipids together, shake them up, right, put them in a jar in some water, they'll automatically make a membrane. They don't need special instructions. Just by their shape, they will form a membrane. So this basic thing that separates all of your living parts from the non-living parts outside just automatically have a tendency to build themselves. That's actually kind of spooky if you think of that. Okay? All right, so that's the phospholipid bilayer. But we all know that different membranes have different functions. All right, when we look at anatomy and physiology. So that means this phospholipid bilayer has some other structural modifications that give it other kinds of functions. And you see other things embedded in the membrane, some other things sticking off the top of the membrane, underneath the membrane. And so it is a complex mixture of a phospholipid bilayer and other kinds of particles. So a better description of a cell membrane, right, is phospholipid bilayer. The better description is the fluid mosaic model. The phospholipid bilayer is very fluid. It's not hard. It won't crack. It won't fracture if you bend it. If you bend it, it will bend with whatever. It will bend very easily. Right, and these other components right here are the mosaic part of that term. The fluid part is the phospholipid bilayer, but in real life there are other things inserted into it, and that is the mosaic part of that concept, fluid mosaic model. So what makes this a mosaic? I see some structure. Here is a protein, and you can see it goes all the way across the membrane. Here is on the outside, here's to the inside of the cell, goes all the way across. And if there is a protein that is embedded within the membrane, like I see right here, we call that an integral protein. It's an integral part of the cell membrane. If we take this protein out of the membrane, then we destroy the membrane. That's another way to think about an integral protein. All right. When I look at this protein right here, I also see something special about it. Not only does it go all the way across from inside to outside, what else do you see?
Channel.
I see, yeah, a nice channel or a tunnel through it. So there are many, many molecules that can't go across the cell membrane or through the phospholipid bilayer, but it can go through this tunnel, which we call a channel. And the cell has the ability to open and close this channel, right? We would call that a gated channel, right? So this protein adds a special function to the membrane, and that means what? Transport across the membrane. This one right here. There could be other proteins. And so this is a protein modified by a sugar, so we call this a glycoprotein. This one could be, for instance, an enzyme, or it could be a receptor. An enzyme speeds up a chemical reaction that otherwise might take 1,000 years to happen, and we don't usually have 1,000 years to wait around for a reaction to take place. This will speed up a reaction. Sometimes it's on the outside of the cell, sometimes it's on the inside of the cell. And here is another integral protein. It goes all the way across the membrane. We could think of this as a receptor. And a receptor is just going to be sensitive to other things that are outside the cell. And when that other thing is outside the cell, it binds to this receptor, and then it changes the physiology inside the cell. All right. So what can be added to a cell membrane to change its function? Channels, okay, enzymes, receptors, and some other things. Carrier molecules, right? Some molecules can't get through a tunnel or a channel. So there is a protein that can grab it on one side and bring it to the inside of the cell because it can't get through the phospholipid bilayer by itself. These little stop signs are representing a single sugar molecule like glucose, and they can be put together in a number of different ways depending on what corner of the sugar molecule gets added to the next one. The shape can change, and there's almost an infinite number of shapes that it can make. These things are what we call antigens. So cell membranes can contain antigens. Antigens stick out into the outside world, not to the inside of the cell. And what they are, they're a signpost that says that they belong to a whole group of cells that you're going to call you. So these things, by the shape of these antigens, will determine whether or signifies to the outside world that this cell belongs to you. That's pretty handy. But it's even more handy if a cell gets into your body that is not you, it has a different shaped antigen, and guess what? Since it has a different shaped antigen, your immune system will be able to identify it as not being part of you, right? It has infected you, and then what would you think the immune system does? If it's a nice, healthy immune system, it will figure out a way to kill that cell because it doesn't belong there, okay? Even tumor cells, cells that maybe belong to you, have different kinds of antigens, and a lot of times a person's immune system will kill that cancer before you even know it. As a matter of fact, we probably have all had cancer cells, but our immune system has been smart enough to recognize it and kill it before it has become a problem. Okay, those that actually develop a diagnosable form of cancer, for some reason, those cells have figured out a way to hide from that person's immune system. All right, so a really interesting way to cure cancer would be to train somebody's immune system to recognize those cells, and that's how we understand how spontaneous remission in cancer can occur sometimes. Right? When a person's own immune system learns to kill those cells all by itself. That's a really nice, easy way of doing it, if possible. All right, I see some other things embedded inside the membrane, and I see it labeled as cholesterol. Cholesterol is a lipid or a fat, just like these little tails right here are lipids. So remember, oil and oil mixes together very nice. Oil and water does not. You have water inside the cell, so cholesterol likes to hide out inside the membrane because that's the oily part. And what can you tell me about cholesterol, good or bad? Can you give me a nice, simple answer? You can't really. Oh, I think my microphone just went off. You can't really because sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, right? If it's in the proper concentration, it's good. What color is that? Red's bad. Okay. Cholesterol. With the right concentration, cholesterol is used to make steroids, including sex steroids, estrogen, testosterone. So if you wanted to deplete your body of cholesterol, you would not be able to make any of those steroids. And I don't know anybody that would raise their hand for that. And other kinds of steroids that control other things inside your body. So it's a precursor molecule. What I see on this slide is that cholesterol is embedded in the membrane, and it gives the membrane some structure, a little bit of rigidity. Because that phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, and without cholesterol, it just might drip out of your body onto the floor. That's maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, okay, but not too big of an exaggeration. Cholesterol gives it a little bit more sturdy kind of structure. That's why cholesterol is there. And then also, since cholesterol is there, your body has a source of cholesterol in case it wants to make testosterone or estrogen or progesterone or other kinds of steroids in the body. All right, I got two batteries left, but I don't know if they're good or not. Let's try it. Let's try it. Unless somebody's got double A's. Here we go. Okay, it's off. I'll turn it back on without turning the volume down. Should I try that? Be ready to grab your ears in case. I heard a little click. Not bad. Okay, here's the sign-in sheet. Don't forget how important it is to sign the sign-in sheet before you go. I'll put it on the front desk right here. Nice. There were a couple people in Monday's lab. Sorry, I got to take a break because I just remembered. A couple people in Monday's lab that I gave an add code to, and you have not registered yet. And when everybody looks at those classes, including my boss and me, it says that that class is not full. So please, everybody that I gave an add code to, you have to register after class because those add codes are going to become invalid, and then I'll give an add code to somebody else that wants to take the class, right? So you got to use that add code because then I know you're serious that you're going to take the class, okay? And just apply that to all of my labs. If I give you an add code, act on it the very same day because it's really important. Every seat in here is very valuable to a lot of students. All right, so this is the phospholipid bilayer. The fluid mosaic model really describes it better because of all this other junk that can be assembled and put into the membrane, and these are different structures that are put in the membrane. So what does that mean about the function of the membrane? It can have different functions, all depending on what kinds of things are inserted into the membrane. And guess what controls that? It is the nucleus of the cell. All right. And as a matter of fact, if it's one cell, if it's one cell, right, there can be different things in the membrane over here compared to over here. So different sides of the cell can have different functions even. So that's pretty cool. All right, what are some other things? Well, we have these layers of membranes, and what's the basic structure of, this is what we call rough endoplasmic reticulum. What's the basic structure of endoplasmic reticulum? It's a membrane. You would want to say phospholipid bilayer, because all membranes are made that way. And remember, they can even make themselves. All right, I see little dots on this particular membrane system, this endoplasmic reticulum. These little dots represent ribosomes. I see some in the cytosol as well. The function of a ribosome is to make proteins. Have you heard of a protein before? Maybe. Maybe some of you even know what the building block of a protein is. It's not so important in this class, but in physiology it's real important. It is what? An amino acid is a building block for a protein. A protein is just one important biological, molecule in your body. And you've got a couple. You've got proteins, you've got sugars, okay, you've got nucleic acids, which make DNA, right? And the one more is lipids, fats. So you've got proteins, fats, sugars, and then genetic material made out of nucleic acids. Those are the four basic ones. And the ribosome is responsible for making one of those, and that is, in particular, proteins. So a ribosome is the workbench where a protein is assembled from amino acids, right? From amino acids. So I see these ribosomes on endoplasmic reticulum making it a rough surface, kind of looks like sandpaper. So what is the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum? Because it has a ribosome, the function is, in two words, but it's actually one word, it is protein synthesis, right? Rough ER. Protein synthesis. I see another membrane system out over here. Kind of looks like rough endoplasmic reticulum. It is endoplasmic reticulum. Does not have ribosomes. So we call it smooth endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so what's the function of this? Can it be protein synthesis? Well, you still have to take a little guess. And the little guess would be because it doesn't have ribosomes, it cannot make proteins. That would be a really good assumption. Okay. So smooth endoplasmic reticulum is responsible for making other things, and a good thing to say is that it makes lipids. Okay, it makes lipids. Rough ER makes proteins. Smooth ER makes lipids, special kinds of lipids. We talked about one, a phospholipid. It can make those things. Another important thing that rough ER does is that it stores a little molecule that's important to make bones, and it's important all over your body, and that is calcium. It can store calcium. That's kind of obscure. Your book maybe mentions it in one or two places, but in physiology that's going to be really important, right? So maybe two things you should know about smooth ER. Stores calcium, reservoir for calcium, and it can synthesize lipids. All right. Let me go over this. All right, so we have rough ER. Oh, I guess I got to tell you what this thing is. I told you what this thing is in lab. This is the nucleus, right? And inside the nucleus is genetic material. You have nucleic acids that make up chromosomes that are inside the cell. And all of that genetic material is protected from everything that's happening inside the cell and even in the outside world with another membrane. We call that the nuclear envelope. Right, and what's the basic structure of this nuclear envelope? You would want to say, since it's a membrane, it's a phospholipid bilayer. All right, so you're beginning to get the idea that you need a lot of phospholipids inside of a cell to make all these membranes. Indeed, you do. Okay, this nucleolus here is the active part of the nucleus, and we'll talk about activity of a nucleus in a little bit. And that's the nucleus. Right here. It contains information on how to make a protein, how to put amino acids together to make a particular protein, how the structure of that protein, which then determines the function. All right. The reason why I'm mentioning this nucleus right here, because it has this curved shape to it, and if we look at the rough endoplasmic reticulum, does the curve of the rough endoplasmic reticulum match the curve of the nucleus, or is it opposite? Does it curve away, or does it curve around the nucleus?
around.
Yeah, it curves around, right? So that's one way that you can tell rough endoplasmic reticulum from the next organelle that we're going to look at, and that is the Golgi body or Golgi apparatus, exactly the same kind of thing. You can see that it kind of curves away from the nucleus. And do you see any ribosomes on the surface of the Golgi apparatus? I can see Golgi apparatus down over here, over here. I can see the surface of it. It's a membrane made out of phospholipid bilayer. But do you see any? Do you see any of these ribosomes like I see here and here on the surface here? Do you see any? No. Yeah, you're shaking your head no. You're a little cautious yet, but you're right. There aren't ribosomes here. So can a Golgi body make a protein?
No.
You cannot. Just like smoothie air, it cannot. Its job is to get proteins that are made by rough ER. When a rough ER makes a protein, it gets trapped in these little spaces that we call cisternae, and then these proteins migrate by a vesicle into the Golgi apparatus, and the Golgi apparatus takes that protein and it modifies the protein, maybe by adding a sugar molecule to it, maybe by adding a lipid molecule, maybe cutting it in half or doing something like that. And then it packages that modified protein into a vesicle, and that vesicle then can move around inside the cell, or it can even go over to the cell membrane, fuse with the cell membrane, and then whatever inside the vesicle is released to the outside of the cell. That process of something that's moving from inside the cell to the outside of the cell is called secretion, right? So the Golgi apparatus is an important step in secretion, is a part of the secretory pathway. If I'm going to write one thing down for the Golgi body, I would say, you know, either packaging into a vesicle or modification. Either one of those are good. Modification and packaging, that's the job of Golgi body. Okay, secretory vesicles. Ah, we talked about that already. Here's a secretory vesicle because it's releasing things to the outside world. And there can be other vesicles inside the cell. Here's a little ball floating around. Here's another little one. Okay, and here's one. These are vesicles. Not all vesicles get transported to the cell membrane. Some stay inside the cell. And these vesicles can have different components on the inside. And sometimes a vesicle will have an enzyme that can digest proteins and break other large molecules down. It's a digestive system. And those things, if they get out of this vesicle, can start to digest the cell itself. And then that eventually will kill the cell. So those digestive enzymes should stay nice and secure inside this vesicle. Some of those digestive enzymes are called lysozyme. And since there's lysozyme, that vesicle is a lysosome. Lysosome. That's the body that contains lysozyme. All right, so if this cell gets infected by bacteria, if the cell is able to jam that bacteria into a lysosome, then the bacteria gets digested, right? So that's a good thing. That's one of the reasons why it's there. But a cell should always be nice and healthy so none of that lysozyme ever gets let loose and running around inside the cell, digesting the cell. That happens, unfortunately. We'll talk about that maybe a little bit later in the class. Lysosome. Sometimes these vesicles contain enzymes that can not only break a cell down, but can detoxify certain compounds. So it might contain a chemical called peroxidase. That's an enzyme. And so that thing then would be called a peroxisome. Peroxisome for detoxification. So vesicles could be what? Digestion. Could be detoxification, depending on what's inside of this thing. And what's inside of this thing came from this rough endoplasmic reticulum. So a protein that's made by rough endoplasmic reticulum has two fates. It could end up outside the cell, or it could be trapped inside of a vesicle for its entire life, but it never runs around in the cytosol all by itself. It's always behind a membrane someplace. Okay, what's next? Ah, mitochondria. This is a really nice freaky one right here. I see not just one membrane, but two membranes. So this is it has a double membrane. And whenever a membrane is used to make an organelle like mitochondria or the nucleus or endoplasmic reticulum, whether it's rough or smooth, we say that organelle is membrane bound. That means there's a membrane around it. That's all that means. Membrane bound means there's a membrane around it. And what can you tell me about that membrane? Phospholipid bilayer, right? That's a good place to start. There are some organelles that are not membrane bound. They don't have a membrane around them. I'll show you those in a second, but I see one right here, a centriole. All right, so let's get back to mitochondria. Has two membranes. It has an inner membrane. These folds right here are what we call Christi membranes, and then here's one on the outside. We just call that the outer mitochondrial membrane. The fluid that's inside the Christi membrane is what we call the matrix, and this is a really special little beast, and it is a beast. If you take a microbiology class, you'll notice that the shape of this mitochondria is almost identical to the shape of a, does anybody know the shape of a? Bacterium, a bacillus in particular, right? And here is something interesting. This mitochondria, the matrix is cytoplasm, and this membrane is like a cell membrane, and this mitochondria is the only organelle besides the nucleus that has genetic material. It has genetic material all by itself, and it controls its own rate of growth, or what we call replication inside the cell. So what do we call something that has a cell membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material? We call it a cell, right? And that is our understanding of this mitochondria. Okay, the job of the mitochondria is to make the energy that runs this cell that's called ATP. So probably write that down. Mitochondria is the powerhouse. It makes ATP that runs all the living processes inside the cell. And we now know that mitochondria at one time was a bacterium that infected a cell that had a nucleus, right? And then a special arrangement was developed between this bacteria that infected the cell and the cell itself. We call it a symbiosis. What is a symbiosis? Yeah, it's when two organisms come together and each organism provides something for the other one that is able to keep it alive. That's a symbiosis. Since this mitochondria was inside the cell, we call that an endosymbiont, right? So this mitochondria infected the cell, and the cell decided to keep this mitochondria around because what is it doing for the cell? It's providing energy. That's a wonderful thing. It's providing ATP. But remember, a true symbiosis is a two-way street. What is the benefit for a mitochondria living inside your cells? A good way to think of it is protection, because you have an immune system that can fight viruses. There are viruses that can infect mitochondria, right? And also, protection is a good thing. Mitochondria, in order to make ATP, they need sugar molecules, and you provide all day long sugar molecules for this mitochondria when you have a milkshake or other kinds of things. Right, so this mitochondria gets fed. I'd hang around if I got fed all day long, right? It gets fed and it's protected so it doesn't get killed. That's what it gets from this cell, and this cell gets ATP. That's a really nice arrangement, right? So we call that the endosymbiont theory of this mitochondria. All right, so for this class, what's the function of this mitochondria? Makes ATP, makes energy for the cell. ATP, I don't know if everybody has heard of that term, ATP. It's sort of like an acronym for a much longer term called adenosine triphosphate, but it's a very important energy molecule, and we're just going to call it ATP in this particular class. And where does it come from? Mitochondria, if you give them sugars, for instance, and they also need oxygen. And do you provide oxygen to this mitochondria? Yeah, because you breathe. Right, so that's another thing a mitochondria gets. One of the byproducts of making ATP is CO2. Right, so you inhale to get oxygen to these mitochondria, and why do you exhale? To get rid of the CO2 that the mitochondria make as a byproduct when they make ATP. Okay, that's one good way to think of that. Okay, here I see, I'm going to scroll through a couple cells, a couple slides right here. Okay, nice. Okay, here we see it, I zoomed in region of rough endoplasmic reticulum. Here's that Golgi apparatus, and we see the secretory pathway material leaving the cell. And indeed, here is a really nice illustration that shows that whole process of a protein being made inside the rough endoplasmic reticulum and moves over to the Golgi body, and it gets modified. And to me, it just looks like a dot. But does the color of this thing over here, is it different than the color of this thing here? I don't know. But anyway, I would like for this artist to have shown you that there's a change of this molecule somehow, right? Because the job of Golgi is modification, right? So I would like something to change of this little thing that's drawn here. And then it's packaged inside a vesicle, so modification and packaging for a Golgi apparatus. And okay, oh, here's that nice mitochondria, a double membrane system. Here is the matrix. Right, here's the Christie membrane, and this mitochondria needs oxygen and sugar molecules, and what can it make for the cell? ATP. Yeah, it can make ATP. Centrioles. Here are some centrioles. This is where they were hiding out on that first illustration. Maybe a little bit hard to see, but let's zoom into this region and draw it out. Here is a centriole. It looks like two barrel-shaped structures, and they're aligned perpendicular to each other. And their structure, they have a unit called a microtubule. You see these little microtubules right here? If these microtubules are assembled in this particular arrangement, right, and that we can get two centrioles put together, this forms something we call a centrosome. And a centrosome can control the placement of microtubules that move throughout the cell. They're located everywhere inside the cell. And so it can give the cell a particular shape. It's a framework. Like when you build a building, you build the framework first and then fill the walls in. Same thing for these microtubules. You can have cells that are flat. You can have cells that are cubes. You can have cells that look like a column because the centrioles push and pull on these other microtubules throughout the cell to give it that particular shape. And you know what? There's even a special kind of cell in your body that can crawl around. It's a shapeshifter. It's a shapeshifter cell. And it's a white blood cell. It's called a monocyte. And it crawls out of your vascular system into the other parts of your body, and then we give it a different name. We call it a macrophage. And it can crawl around because this centrosome right here can cause these microtubules and filaments to push and pull on certain segments of the plasma membrane and change its shape. It's a shapeshifter kind of cell. Most cells don't really change their shape very much. The other thing that these microtubules can do is that an organelle can attach itself to a microtubule, and the microtubule will carry it to another location within the cell. Like that vesicle that was attached to the Golgi apparatus. It gets over to the cell membrane because it hops a ride on a microtubule that takes it over to the plasma membrane. So when I look at a microtubule, I see just one. It looks like kind of like a train track to me, but only one rail. What do we call a train that only has one rail? Most have two, right? What do we call a train that only has one? Monorail. Is there any? They're strange. They're very rare. But you could look at one today within 10 minutes by going to Disneyland. It has a really cool monorail, and they've had for a long time. So when I look at this system of microtubules inside the cell, I think of it as a network of monorails inside the system, just like what we got over there at Disneyland. Things inside the cell can hop a ride and get to different locations without in the cell. And what controls that activity are the centrioles right here. It controls movement inside the cell. Okay. I maybe talked about the nucleus a little bit. I'll talk about it maybe a little bit more, like real soon. Something that's omitted from this chapter, it's not on this your cell illustration right here. Let me get it up. All right, so here's that basic unit of life, a cell, and it's got all those organelles that we talked about. Here's that centrosome complex. You can see microtubules coming out of it. What the cell does not show you is a certain specialization that will poke away from the cell membrane, and we could call these things microvilli or flagella. Okay, and they have microtubules inside of them, and if it's a flagellum, it's going to be very long, and it can whip around, right? Because that's the job of a microtubule, is moving around. And some people have one cell in their body that can swim around because of that long flagellum. Does anybody know? And it's sexist. It is a sperm cell. Okay, a sperm cell has a flagellum, and it can swim around anywhere in a watery environment because the flagellum is whipping back and forth. And so the job of a flagellum, in one word, is motility. Right? Motility is motion. There is something that is much smaller than a flagellum. It's called a cilium. And a cell doesn't have just one cilium. It has many, so we say cilia for many of them. And again, those cilia can bend, and they can, in some organisms, can actually swim around by the action of cilia, but none in human bodies can do that. The cells that have cilia are anchored in a certain location, and the cilia are beating. They're all beating in one direction, so they can take fluid that's sitting on top of them and get it to move in one direction. So again, that is motility. Cilia, the function of cilia is motility, but it's not because they can swim around. It's because they can move other things that are outside of them. Right? That's the job of cilia. Like, for instance, in our windpipe, we have cells that line our windpipe that have cilia. And those cilia will trap dust particles that we breathe in, which is good because we don't want those dust particles or bacteria getting into our lungs. And once a cilia has them, it sweeps these particles. Which way do you think it sweeps the particles? Up or down into your lungs? Yep. Up into your mouth. Get it out of your body so it doesn't plug up your lungs. And then when all those particles, which also contain mucus, get into your mouth, what do you do then? You probably haven't thought about this, but we all do it all day long. Okay. You just kind of swallow it down, and it gets out of your body that way. Unless you're a baseball player, then what do? All day long, it's amazing. Somebody should measure the volume of spit coming out of a baseball player sometime. I don't know what it is. I know what it is for a normal person. I don't know what it is for a baseball player. But we could probably guess it's more. All right, so flagella function is motility. Cilia function is motility again, but a little bit different kind. Some other modifications are microvilli. We'll look at those. And the adaptation or the function that microvilli give to the cell, it enhances absorption. So microvilli absorption. So let's see if we can go over some of these things. Let's see if I can remember. Okay. Remember, mitochondria, one function. Makes ATP. That's good. Cross that up. Rough endoplasmic reticulum. Protein synthesis. Nice. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Lipid synthesis. Lipids and proteins are important biological molecules, but they're different. They're really different from each other. Right, so we got mitochondria, smooth, rough. What about a lysosome? Digestion. Okay, what about a peroxisome? Would be detoxification. Bless you. Okay, what else? What else did we talk about? Centrioles. I don't have a nice simple thing for centrioles. Yeah, it controls microtubules inside the cell. And that does a whole bunch of stuff. Could be intracellular motility, moving things around inside the cell. And you know what? These centrioles even control the flagella that we sweep back and forth. So even motility outside, that's okay. I like motility. I like that for centrioles. Motility, but inside the cell. Let me go back to the list over here. Mitochondria, cilia, flagella. I think we covered all this stuff pretty much. Ah, Golgi body. Packaging and modification. And I forgot to mention, for smooth endoplasmic reticulum, there are really two important things. Your book doesn't make a big deal of one of them, but it probably should. You said lipid synthesis. I like that. But an additional function is stores calcium. That's right. So a lot of people think we store calcium in our bones. We do, but there's even another place inside cells, and that is smooth endoplasmic reticulum. that will be important when we get to muscles. Okay? And I think that's pretty much everything of these. So this is an exam figure, basic building block of life. It probably has a high priority of being put on a lecture exam. Okay? Because it's so important. It is really important. So know the function by its particular shape. And remember, shape determines the function. The nucleus here determines the shape of all of these things. So the nucleus determines the function of everything that's happening inside the cell as a result of that. Okay. I did see an interesting slide as I zipped through them. And I saw an ATP go by. And I'm going to find that in just a second. So let's move on to the next topic. Okay. Movement across a membrane. There, I have a one and a two. So there are two possible ways that we can think of membrane transport, or how something can get from the inside to the outside of the cell, or vice versa, from the outside to the inside, okay, through the membrane. And the membrane can select how that happens. It can be a passive process, or it can be an active process. You could probably guess what that means. A passive process is one that will happen automatically, all by itself, without needing a battery or any other form of energy. Okay? Your cell phone needs a battery. So if your cell phone needs a battery, is it a passive device or an active device? Yeah, if a process requires energy from another source, we call that an active process. Your cell phone is an active device, not a passive device. All right, so membrane transport can rely on either of those two. If it's passive, and something moves from one area to another, and it can even be across the membrane, but it doesn't even have to be across a membrane. It can just be even in this room. We call that diffusion. When a molecule can move without any input of energy from one location to the next, that is diffusion. Will not require ATP. For instance, if I have a perfume bottle right here, and I walked in from outside the room to the inside of the room, meaning there is no perfume in this room when I walked in, when I open the bottle, the perfume evaporates into the air, and then what happens? Even though I don't have a fan on in here, what's going to happen to that perfume? First, you're going to smell it in the first row, and then the second row is going to smell it, which means that molecule is going to move, right, all the way up to the back of the room. And the way it moves is by the concentration difference. When I open up the bottle, there's a high concentration of molecules, a lot of perfume molecules right here, and what is it in the back of the room? Zero, right? So it's going to want to go from high concentration to low concentration. It needs that difference in concentration in order to go from one area to another. All right, so today's Wednesday. I have that perfume bottle open, and I forget to close it, and we come back in the room on Monday morning. What's going to be the concentration of that perfume in the back of the room compared to the front of the room? This is sort of interesting. Okay. Well, since it had all weekend to move around, it's going to be identical in the back compared to the front. It's going to be the same concentration everywhere in the room, right? Same concentration. All right. And when there's no difference in concentration, what can you tell me about diffusion? It stops. All right. So when the perfume molecule is at the same concentration everywhere in the room, diffusion stops. And it's just linearly related to that. If the concentration is big, diffusion is fast. If the concentration difference is small, diffusion is slow. And further that concept, if there's no concentration difference, then there is no diffusion taking place. And what's the energy source for diffusion? You would want to say, it doesn't require energy. It's passive. Right? It does not require ATP. Okay, so that's what we mean by diffusion. Every molecule will go from high concentration to low concentration. Is that kind of ringing a bell for anybody? Sort of. I have a pretty good example. Hopefully I can do it fast. Do I have a marker right here? Good enough. Can you see it? Can I erase that? I can. Can you see that in the back of the room? Sort of. Good enough. Okay. Well, when I was in college, I had a really cool car. It was called an MGB. Has anybody ever heard of an MGB? Well, it was really old. and it was about this big. It was really, really small. And it was a stick shift, so it was really fun to drive around. MGB is a British car, also a British car, not very reliable. Also, what that means, not American, not Japanese, British. It was an MGB. So sometimes after school, I would get out, I would sit in my little MGB, turn the key, and nothing would happen. All right, battery was dead. Or I turned the key and the starter motor was burned out. And I discovered a whole bunch of reasons why a car won't start because it was old. Those are just two reasons. All right, but it was a manual transmission, so when I parked the car, I would never know if I turned the key if the car would start. So I would park the car in a particular location to where I knew I could start the car all the time. Anybody have a guess where that would be? Some of you are smiling. You're parked already just like this, I'm sure. You're parked on a hill someplace, right? So the car's on the hill, and I would put it in neutral, and it was a really little car. I could get the car started going down the hill by just pushing with my left foot, and it would start to roll down the hill, get faster, 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 pop the clutch, turn the engine over, and I could go home, right? And fortunately, I had a hill at home, so I could get to school, too. All right, so here is that hill. Ah, what happened to my marker? It dried out while I was yakking, okay? Maybe I can get it back. What about this one here? Dark enough? Different color, but maybe dark enough. Here's that hill, right? And here's my car, right here. At another time, I would park my car here, on that hill. And this car can go up the hill, it can go down the hill, but when it's going down the hill from high to low, am I burning? Do I have to have gasoline to get it to go down? Do I need energy? No, it happens automatically. So from going from high, right, high to low is what? Active or passive? Here's passive. So remember that. High to low, passive. Right? The reverse process is possible. I can go from low to high, but what's required here? Yeah, gas. And you, what's required? ATP. And what kind of process is this when something goes from low to high concentration? That is active. All right, that's what we mean. Okay. And for diffusion, which one is it? Car going down the hill, car going up the hill? Diffusion is going down the hill. Okay, from high concentration to low concentration. So here's where the perfume bottle would be, and then low concentration would be up at the top of the room. Okay. Is that a little bit better? You have to work with that some. All right, so let's get back to the slides. Eraser. Here is an eraser. Let's work with a little bit more of a molecular view. All right, so here we have a molecule over here and over here. We have the same kind of molecule over here. All right, I don't want to take too much time. Right, but can you tell these two locations are different from each other? Can you see that they're different? Do you see a difference? Same color, I hope. All right, but this is what we call high concentration, a lot of particles here in the small volume. Here, very few in that same volume. So high concentration, low concentration. So by diffusion, these molecules will want to come over to here until the concentration is the same. So that's what we call, what do we call that when something moves from high to low concentration? Diffusion, yeah. Okay, if we change this arrangement a little bit, we get something called osmosis. Okay, so osmosis, your book says, is diffusion. Osmosis is diffusion. So which way do things move for osmosis? From high concentration to low concentration because it's diffusion, right? By osmosis, these things will move over to here. Right? But for osmosis, there has to be some other kinds of criteria. All right. So we'll say diffusion first. Is one thing. The second thing is that for osmosis to take place, there has to be a membrane between these two places. And you're familiar with membranes. What should I draw here? One line or two lines? Two lines, yeah. Phospholipid bilayer. Here is a nice membrane. Okay, and some of these particles, oh, let me draw another particle. Here's a square one. A square one cannot get through the membrane. It bounces off. These circular ones can get through the membrane based on their shape, for instance. Okay, so this membrane is special. It allows some things through, but not everything. We call that semi-permeable or selectively permeable. That's another criteria for osmosis. A particle has to move through a selectively permeable membrane. Or semi. Let's say semi. Same thing as selective. Permeable. You all know what permeable means? It just means something can move through it. Right? And semi means some things can, some things can't. And a good example of that would be a cell membrane. Cell membranes are selectively permeable. Right? And then one last thing. Okay, one last thing. I got to tell you what a solution is. Maybe some of you know what a solution is. Not a solution to a mathematical problem or a physics problem, but I don't know, maybe I could come up with some of those in here, but maybe later. Okay. But in terms of chemistry, what's a solution? It has two parts to it. Okay. It's got something called the solvent and something called the solute. These two things. The solvent is the liquid part of a solution. Like for us, when we drink coffee, the solvent part would be the water, right? And the solute are the particles that dissolve in water. Or like Coca-Cola, the solute would be all the sugar molecules in there and all the other things, right, that we can taste. And the solvent would be water. So for osmosis to take place, it has to be the solvent molecule. All right, so let's put this down for number three, solvent. Not any solutes, but solvent. And remember, solvent is just a part of a solution because you're basically a solution of chemicals running around inside your body. Okay, solvent. What's the solvent inside your body?
Water.
Yeah, it's water. Everything's dissolved in water. So this molecule right here in us, you could think of as water. So a lot of definitions use water for osmosis, but it doesn't hold true in every particular case. And that's pretty much. All right, so here we have a molecule going from, I'll put water here. Here we have water going from high concentration to low. What is that basic process called? Diffusion. Okay. It's going through this membrane. What is this membrane special? Yeah, it's semi-permeable, lets some things through but not everything. All right, and what can you tell me about water? It is the solvent molecule. So is this a good example of osmosis? Yeah, it satisfies all those conditions, right? Okay, so osmosis is just a special kind of diffusion. And is it active or passive? It's passive, right? Doesn't require any energy. A lot of things move around in your body and even from inside to outside your body, or from outside to inside your body by diffusion. That's how oxygen enters your body, because it's low inside, it's high in the air. That's how carbon dioxide leaves your body, because it's high inside, it's low. Carbon dioxide is almost zero in the air. So it really likes to get out of your body and jump into the air. Okay, active transport requires ATP. Here is ATP. There is energy in ATP in the form of chemical energy. There are bonds that hold various atoms together in ATP. Those bonds have energy. When you break the bonds, that energy can be released and used by other kinds of processes. Right? When the bonds in ATP are broken to get at some of that energy, it's converted into ADP and what we call inorganic phosphate. Right? ATP, this T stands, I guess you should know a little bit, ATP, this T stands for tri. What does tri mean?
Three.
And this P is phosphorus, so there are three phosphorus atoms on this molecule, and that gets converted to ADP, that stands for di. Does anybody know what di means? Two, right? So there are two phosphates on this molecule, and then here's a free one running around, one. and also energy. So when ATP is broken down into a group that has two, another one that has one, what else is released? Energy. And that can be used for all kinds of things, maybe nerve impulses, or for transport of molecules across the membrane. From how? From low concentration to high concentration, which won't happen automatically. But if you use ATP, right, then you can use an active process for transportation. So that's why we say low to high, opposite for passive. We can have molecular transport. There can be proteins inside the cell membrane that can actually move a molecule from low to high concentration, but it requires ATP. ATP is going to be used up. We don't make a whole lot of that in this class, but in physiology, that's really important, and we'll have some really nice graphics that show molecular transport. Or another form of transport would be macromolecular transport. So big, huge molecules that could never move across the cell membrane, okay, can be imported into the cell, and we're going to use this illustration here as an example. So here we have some particles outside the cell, and the cell wants it on the inside. So the membrane will start to bulge to the inside of the cell. That creates a space that's sort of inside the cell, but it's connected to the outside. So these particles can move into that little bulge. The bulge gets deeper and deeper and deeper, and then finally pinches off from the cell membrane. So it's the reverse of this process right here. Right? So here we have particles outside the cell. They go into here. This vesicle forms, so now you have the particles that were outside the cell, inside the cell. That requires energy to move those membranes around with microtubules, for instance. Okay, when something enters the cell by this vesicle means, we call that phagocytosis. Phagocytosis. Right, do I have that? I do have phagocytosis right here. All right, if it's a particulate matter, if it is just a pure solution, if it's just a liquid, we call it pinocytosis. So phagocytosis is what we call cell eating. Literally, that's what that means. Cyto is cell, phago is eating in Latin. And pinocytosis, pino is drinking, cell drinking. Both of these together, right, represent ways things can go from outside to inside. Sometimes we call that endocytosis. Endocytosis is getting inside the cell, and it could be one of these two processes here, phago or pinocytosis. What we see on this illustration is a particle that's inside the cell, inside of a vesicle, and because of these processes, it eventually ends up outside the cell, right? It's secreted outside the cell. We call that secretion, but in terms of cytosis, that is exocytosis, okay? Exocytosis. And we don't make a distinction between fluids leaving the cell or solids leaving the cell. I was thinking of some really gross thing of how things leave your body, but I won't make an analogy. Okay. All right. Let's look at protein synthesis. What time are we done here? 12:05. Okay. Well, next time, we're going to look at protein synthesis. Don't forget to sign the sign-in sheet. Protein is one of four super important biological molecules in your body. We're going to see how they're made next time. You don't have to hit submit. But you know, you probably want it to be graded so you know which ones you got right and wrong.
Okay, but
yeah.
Like,
you don't have to email it to me.
Okay.
If there's no dollar sign, that's it. But some of those questions I might put on the lecture exam, so they're probably important.
So the ones that we do need to finish by Thursday is the quiz.
The dollar sign.
Okay, but everything else is like for us to do on our own time?
Yep. 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 Dollar sign is for course points, and that's Thursday.